with you. We're going to finish up Romans 14. Apologies if my voice is not as strong or as good as normal. Had a physical today and left with an antibiotic, so I've got a sinus infection that's been with me for a couple of weeks now, and I'm just glad it's been diagnosed with something, because I tested negative for COVID and all this stuff. It's just like, well, I don't feel right, so I would sure like to know what's happening. So at least I know what's happening now, so hopefully I'll feel a little bit better in a week or so. But we're going to start in Ephesians here, just because this is kind of where we left off, and then we're just going to hit Romans 14, 20 through 23 and finish, and then we can move to the second part of the program tonight. But Ephesians 4, 10 through 16, we covered this last time, and you can notice what I have highlighted in purple. And I use purple usually when it's about Christ and something that speaks to me. If I highlight in purple on here, it's a similar way that I do that on my iPad when I'm reading through various commentaries and stuff. If it's about Christ, for some reason, purple just comes to mind. And then red is something that oftentimes represents negative, but in this case, it does not. But it just reads, and I think it's just important to hear again, "He who descended is the one who also ascended far above all the heavens, that he might fill all things. And he gave the apostles, the prophets, the evangelists, the shepherds, and teachers to equip the saints for the work of ministry, for building up the body of Christ until we all attain to the unity of the faith and of the knowledge of the Son of God, to mature manhood, to the measure of the stature of the fullness of Christ, so that we may no longer be children tossed to and fro by the waves and carried about by every wind of doctrine, by human cunning, by craftiness and deceitful schemes, rather speaking the truth in love. We are to grow up in every way into him who is the head, into Christ, from whom the whole body, joined and held together by every joint with which it is equipped, when each part is working properly, makes the body grow so that it builds itself up in love." Interestingly, if you listen Sunday on any of our campuses, it was about spiritual gifts. You know what this passage is? It's about spiritual gifts. The Corinthians passage that was touched on is more the supernatural side. There's a Roman spiritual gifts portion, which we have already covered, which is more the material side, more the human side. And here we kind of have, these are the functional jobs. This isn't speaking in tongues. These are those that are talking. These are those that are shepherding. And it's just interesting that we find ourselves here. But I was telling Buck beforehand, it seems like that's happening a lot lately. If you listen to the preaching that our campuses are going through, or if you listen to various sermons, it seems like all of them relate to where we find ourselves in Romans. It's almost like Romans is almost like a skeleton key that really helps unlock everything else, and it just feels like everything is in sync. And I think that's pretty cool, quite frankly. So now we can hit these last few verses, 20 and 21 in chapter 14. "Do not, for the sake of food, destroy the work of God. Everything is indeed clean, but it is wrong for anyone to make another stumble by what he eats. It is good not to eat meat or drink wine or do anything that causes your brother to stumble." And we've talked about this quite a bit in these past few weeks. Grant Osborne in his commentary says, "It is a sin to damage a fellow believer spiritually just so you can flaunt your own freedom." Just because you're okay with it, if that person's not, then it is sin for them to do it, because their conscience, you can't go against your conscience. Conscience of the weak, they have no choice in the matter. "I can't eat meat. I can't do this on this certain day." Conscience of the strong, you can do it either way. Where your faith finds it and where Jesus is and what you understand that he did for you on the cross gives you the ability to do that. And then Paul basically tells everyone here in this chapter, do what is best for the weaker believers and the community as a whole. Because the last thing you want to do is be a stumbling block to somebody's relationship with Christ and their walk with Christ. Because no one in this room had the same pathway. No one in this room got to Christ with the same amount of steps or anything else. We started at a different place. You'll hear mine and where I started from and how far I've come. And all of you have wonderful stories, but they're all unique stories. So we have to remember there are those that are not as far along in their journey. That does not make them weak in a negative sense. It just means they haven't fully been able to embrace what Christ accomplished for them on the cross. And so that should be our joy, to watch them grow into that, as opposed to, "I can eat meat and I'm going to do it in front of you and flaunt it." That's not a Christian way to live. Do nothing to harm another believer spiritually. The word destroy. Remember verses 15 and 16. Do not destroy the one for whom Christ died. And now, do not for the sake of food destroy the work of God. Notice these two things. They're the same. Destroy the one for whom Christ died, the work of God. What is the work of God? Christ. Our sanctification, our justification, ultimately his glorification. So those two things are basically the same. That's why we looked at that chiastic structure, which I'll show it to you again here in just a minute, where everything just sort of plays right to the center. And the center is the key of the entire message. Osborne, work of God includes the redemptive work of Christ. That's verse 16, the one for whom Christ died. Work of salvation in the weaker believers. And thus he says, if they don't get their act together, two destructive forces will be unleashed. Individual believers are going to be destroyed spiritually, and the work of God in the community as a whole will be destroyed. Because those individual believers who walk away from the church and walk away from Christ and say, no, I don't want to be a part of that, are then going to go to the community and say, you can't trust those people. They don't love. They don't serve. They don't help. They lord. They stand on a pedestal. All of those things. Some references scripturally real quick. This is the work of God that you believe.
It's John 6:29.
The work of God. Do not destroy the work of God that you believe. That you is everyone. That you is everyone that could potentially believe. That's the work of God. Believe in whom, in him whom he has sent. 1 Corinthians 14:26. Let all things be done for building up. Again, the whole thing is about unity in the church. Building up the church. Because the church is Christ. The church is Christ manifest here. This is where the kingdom has broken through the most, where we are starting to glimpse that future glory. So all of it is about everyone looking at the same Lord, the same Christ, the same cross. Not from this person over here is not as good because he came from this side of the world, or this person over here didn't have the right family, or this person didn't do this properly or that properly. No, we're all looking here. The ground is level at the foot of the cross, which is something I think Jay even said on Sunday, and we've said a few times in here over the course of the last few months too. In 2 Corinthians, for even if I boast a little too much of our authority, which the Lord gave for building you up and not for destroying you, I will not be ashamed. Again, it's about building up. It's not about tearing down. It's not about destroying people. It's about building the church up, encouraging the church in Jesus Christ. 12:19, same book there, 2 Corinthians. Have you been thinking all along we've been defending ourselves to you? It is in the sight of God that we have been speaking in Christ, and all for your upbuilding, beloved. It is in the sight of God that we have been speaking in Christ. 1 Thessalonians 2, nor did we seek glory from people, whether from you or from others, though we could have made demands as apostles of Christ, but we were gentle among you, like a nursing mother taking care of her own children. Again, gentle, not lording over, not flaunting, not, you know, high stepping into the end zone, if you want a football reference. There's a level of love and care that they showed throughout this, even though they did speak truth in love. It's not as if they were going to allow disobedience and immorality to take over. What was happening in Corinth had to be stopped. The false teaching that was going on in Galatia had to be stopped. And then this disunity and this superiority versus inferiority that was going on in the Church of Rome at the time had to be stopped. But there's a way to do it in love, and there's a way to do it wrong. And I think we all know the difference when we see that. And now the last couple verses here. And this is kind of, I think, the biggest portion of all of this. The faith that you have, keep between yourself and God. Blessed is the one who has no reason to pass judgment on himself for what he approves. But whoever has doubts is condemned if he eats, because the eating is not from faith. For whatever does not proceed from faith is sin. But aren't we supposed to share our faith? Isn't the whole thing... I don't know, how many times did Mike Glenn say gospel conversations? how many sermons in a row? 20 years worth, probably, of gospel conversation sermons. What are you saying, Paul? The faith you have, keep between yourself and God. What is the faith that you have? Anybody have a thought on what the faith that you have means? Is it equal?
So my version has something a little different.
Sure.
It says, whatever you believe about these things.
Mm-hmm.
And so it references those sentences prior to how I feel that it's talking about.
So,
not the faith in Christ.
Right. So if you look at the Greek, I have it listed down here, the faith that you have, the stuff that's in parentheses wouldn't be included. It would just be sort of implied. Faith you have by yourself in the opinion of God. Happy or blessed the one not judging himself with regard to what he judges to be good. But what you're saying, right, the faith, what it is the level of faith, the measure of faith that you have is the measure of faith that you have. That is not then to be enforced on everyone else, because they may not be where you are. We're in the same thing that we were just saying about the weaker believer and their walk and where they find themselves compared to where you walk. You go on a youth retreat, there's, 10 teenagers with me on a youth retreat in North Carolina where they were way ahead in their journey. And so they couldn't then just bring me to that place because everything's gradual. As cool as it is to be there, if you're in ministry or if you're having gospel conversations, there is going to be that moment where somebody comes to Christ. And it's going to be the coolest thing that you've ever experienced. Most of the time, it doesn't work like that. Most of the time, it takes a lot of time, and it takes a lot of different people probably touching this person's life in different moments, suggesting different books, reading scripture, praying over the person, intercession, all of that kind of stuff. So again, the faith that you have by yourself in the opinion of God. Whatever your degree of faith is, wherever you are in your walk with Christ, you keep that to yourself. You don't say, well, you aren't at my level. That's essentially what he is saying here. He's not saying, stay quiet. I mean, Paul never stayed quiet about his faith. That was his entire, I figure if he slept, he probably did it in his sleep. In dreams, I bet a lot of people came to Christ as well. So Douglas Moo says, the silence that Paul requires is related to the need to avoid putting a stumbling block in the way of the weak. Basically, you don't brag about your convictions before the weak, and you don't propagandize the weak. You don't give them more than they can handle, and you don't tell them they're inferior because they're not where you are at that point. The faith is not saving faith, to your point. Throughout 14, it's not saving faith. It's not Christian faith. It's the faith of the strong and weak groups to believe what Christ said about the law no longer being binding on God's people. That's these things that you were referencing. It's these middle ground issues that Scripture doesn't definitively tell you yes or no on. It's what's called disputed matters, which we talked about a couple of different times. I put down several theologians here because it can be kind of difficult to get through this. Leon Morris says he is thinking, Paul here, rather the faith that enables anyone who has it to follow without hesitation or scruple a course of action which his weaker brother cannot follow. That faith he should not parade, but exercise it where only he knows about it. Here is the idea again of, if you go against your conscience, you are sinning. If your conscience tells you you can't eat that, whether or not we know differently, because of where we are and what we believe about Christ and what we've been taught. If we then make that person eat and they do it, but they don't have the same degree of faith that we have, they are sinning. They are disobeying. They are being disobedient because they're not at a level where they're doing that in faith. They're doing that for the wrong reasons. And so again, we can't be a stumbling block. So if my faith's at 100, I don't even know what that means. But if my faith's at 100 and this person over here is at 40 and that person is not doing something that I deem that's okay to do at my level of faith, if I convince that person to do it, but their faith is not to the degree where that's all right, that's sin. And so we have to be very, very cautious about that. Again, here we go. Defiling one's conscience. Verse 23 is a challenge. This is a beatitude for the strong. Almost every theologian agrees this. This is This is written for the strong. There is freedom that is a true joy when one's faith allows for him to eat anything and treat all days equally. And then in 23, he turns his attention to the weak. Going against your conscience is sin, even though we know our conscience is not infallible. Our conscience is all we have. Our conscience is the closest thing that we can fathom. So if we're going against our conscience, we're doing something we believe to be morally wrong, whether or not it is or not. And then we go back to verse 5 quickly. Let each one be completely certain in his own mind. This is what Paul says. That again, faith beyond reproach. Walking truly in faith. You're not just doing it because everybody told you to do it. You're doing it because you have faith that tells you it's okay. So basically what Paul is, I'll answer this question. What is Paul warning the weak of in verse 23? Jumping the gun to exercise something that your conscience tells you is wrong because of the other people around you. Until your faith says it's okay, it's not okay. When these disputed matters, when it comes to eating and all this, and that was a huge thing, you had to follow your conscience, and if you were still weak in the faith in terms of you didn't realize that the law didn't apply anymore, then the law still applied because it was your conscience. So here is basically all of it boiled down to finish. Everyone has to be faithful to their own conscience. What is right for one group may be wrong for another. Why is that? Because all Christians are responsible to God to live according to the level of their faith, the measure of the faith that has been poured out for you. Other things like that. You are responsible to God for whatever level of faith that you have. So if their conscience gives them a faith that says the Mosaic law is still binding upon them, then this is what they are divinely condemned if they eat. Because they're doing it when they believe it to be disobedient. That sounds very complicated, but again, if you are not to the spot where your faith tells you that that's not disobedient and that's not sin, then it is. Eating in doubt means eating without the faith that makes it right in the sight of God. That makes it sin because you're going against your God-given conscience. And now, the chiasm that I referred to again. Back to 13, warning against a stumbling block. Ends, warning against being a stumbling block. Nothing is unclean. Christ declared all food is unclean. All food is clean. Do not destroy another by stressing your freedom. Do not destroy the work of God. Do not destroy the one for whom Christ died. Do not destroy the work of God. Same thing. And then dead center, what does it all come around? God's kingdom means peace and joy. Seek peace and mutual edification. You will not have peace, joy, mutual edification, love, any of those things, if you are lording your freedom or flaunting it in the face of weak believers who are then going to sin. And that can happen in a church really, really easily. And that's Paul's message here. And then Matthew 7. Why do you see the speck that is in your brother's eye, but do not notice the log that is in your own eye? Or how can you say to your brother, let me take the speck out of your eye when there is the log in your own eye? You hypocrite. First take the log out of your own eye, and then you will see clearly to take the speck out of your brother's eye. There are spots where my faith is stronger than anyone else in this room, and there are spots where it is not. There are some things that I'm a lot more rock solid on than other things. And that's still unique. Again, the measure of faith that we have been given. I can notice what I think to be your weaknesses of faith because I'm stronger in those spots. But I'm going to kind of forget. I'm the lawyer. I'm the defense attorney that's going to forget about all those facts that might actually prove the prosecution's case. I'm going to put those over here, and I'm going to focus on this. I'm going to point the finger at you and do my best not to look in the mirror.
So our weaker brethren, we can learn from, just as we can teach. Everyone has to be teachable. And so you look at all of that, and it all comes down to what? It
comes down to love. It comes down to unity. It comes down to building up the church, which is Christ.
And that finishes up Romans 14. And so we'll do 15 and 16 in January, and I look forward to doing it. And so now, see, I don't script this out. The times that I have done this, I've never scripted it out, and I never will. Instead, I prayed yesterday and today that whatever I would say tonight would be from the mouth of the Holy Spirit. Whatever version of this story that needed to be told tonight would be the one that would be told. So I'm just as interested as you hopefully are, because I don't know where it's going to go. I can tell you that I'm not wearing this just because it's December the 4th. I'm wearing it because earlier today, my three-year-old performed here at Brentwood with the other three and four-year-olds and five-year-olds, the Christmas concert. And Clara Grace was crying as I dropped her off this morning and left her in the class because she was so nervous and scared to perform. And she's going through a major shy phase right now. And it was tough. It was tough to watch her tearing up and weeping as I was leaving and trying to tell her, hey, look, I have to go get a physical today. Daddy's got to get a shot. So if you could be strong, then Daddy can be strong. So I need you to be strong. But then the teacher even said, hey, if she's really, really uncomfortable, do you want me to pull her off stage? And I said, I don't want to put her in a bad spot. So yes, if it's out of control, yes. But she got up there and didn't cry and saw us and waved, and we got through it. But your life takes turns when you have kids, and it's almost like I didn't know what life was before that point, because this life is so different over the last 3 years than the one that I experienced for the first 43 years of my life. The perspective that it gives you, the amount of grace you realize you don't possess, the amount of patience that I'm still praying for, and am wondering if I'm equipped for all of this. But I'm a guy who's 46 years old, who grew up in a Methodist church in Martinsville, Virginia, a town that was known for textiles and furniture and NASCAR, and is now unfortunately known for meth and opioids, and has pretty much been ravaged and destroyed. My dad did not go to college. My mom did not go to college. My dad went to work straight out of high school in a textile mill and worked in textiles for the rest of his life. Ended up being a senior buyer of dyes and chemicals for Fruit of the Loom in Bowling Green before he retired. And I never knew during the entire time that I was growing up how close we were to not having enough to make ends meet. He worked hard, and I thought he was a rock star, and he was, but he wasn't a high-paid rock star. And Mom did some work at the plant as well, some order entry work, but she gave that up in order to make sure I was safe at home in the afternoons. And then she started doing 4 p.m. to 12 a.m. shifts. And I would stay with my grandmother until Dad got off work and he would pick me up and all that. But I grew up in Wesley Memorial Church. And I went to a camp when I was, I can't remember exactly. I probably would have been 10 or 11, maybe even 12. And I came back from the camp. The last night of the camp, it was Camp Altamont in Virginia. And I came back from the camp. And that last night that I was there, all these people broke into tears, and they all like had this war in their heads, and they all came to Christ, and there's this crazy deal where it seemed like everybody got saved that night. I didn't, but I came back and lied and said that I did. And went through the confirmation class, went up to the front, received my Bible. Parents were super proud of me. We got to my grandparents' house for a lunch celebration, and I told them I lied. I didn't want to be left out. I wanted to feel what everybody else was feeling, but I have to admit I'm not there. Dad was incredibly disappointed, and he was a God-fearing man. There's no way I would be standing here without growing up listening to the Cathedral Quartet and listening to the Gaithers and listening to Don Francisco and Sandy Patty and everybody else under the sun in the car, because I had no choice. Or listening to Charles Stanley and Chuck Swindoll and Warren Wiersbe. Dad listened to it all the time. He sat in a chair and he took notes as he listened on the radio. And he would record audio tapes and go back and listen to those. And he would sing in the shower. And it was awful. And he did some guest preaching a couple of times. Bored me to tears. He was in the choir. And so was Mom. And he taught Sunday school for 2 decades in Virginia and in North Carolina. He was super involved in the church. I don't think we were ever denominational, because as I've grown older and thought about the Methodists and looked into some things, I wouldn't have chosen to be a Methodist just based on some things that I feel like just aren't quite right. But some wonderful people that I still know, people that were at my wedding. And we moved to North Carolina in 1990. I went to Poptown Baptist Church. And the youth group was big man on campus around there. We did mission trips for Habitat for Humanity in Phelps, Kentucky, and in Charleston, South Carolina. And we performed all the time for the church. We were more important than the actual choir. The power that the youth group held there was dangerous, quite frankly, and they kind of got away with a lot. And by they, I mean we. And we did things we shouldn't have done, and certainly weren't reflections of Christ in any way, shape, or form. And, you know, when you're going on youth trips and there's premarital sex and there's alcohol and there's all these kinds of things popping up, something's gone wrong. And at my age, I was too dumb to see it. I didn't know what was going on, but I did in 1992 get baptized. And that was the real one, the one where I did lie, the one where I actually was baptized. But then I decided, once saved, always saved, I'll get right with you down the road. I got a life to live. So I'm going to go to high school. And I'm going to be a church in name only kind of guy. You'll know me because I go to Poptown Baptist Church. You'll know me because I do a lot of play leads or sing or do all these various things. But I'm not going to be somebody you want on a Christian journey with you at this point. I'm just not ready. I'm not mature enough to even care. Sometime around age 13. Essentially, I'm reading this book right now on proximics, which is about distance between people in various rooms and how there's 5 different size gatherings that we as people engage in, that there's different rules that govern what you can and can't say in certain rooms. And this is a discipleship book, and it's built off the fact that Christ had 5 different sizes of relationships, going all the way down to one-on-one, him and the Father. It's him and the Father, him and the 3, him and the 12, him and the 70, and then him and the thousands. And so I'm in a room where I'm kind of in that mix between the room where it's okay to share certain things and it's not okay to share certain things. But I also said, once this came to an end in my life, that there would never be a room and there would never be a time when I would not share this. But when I was 13... I fell into pornography and fell into it hardcore. And it was innocent enough at first, and it would just kind of escalate and escalate and escalate and escalate. And it escalated for over 30 years. And it made me think the absolute worst of myself. It left me embarrassed, humiliated, alone, empty, destroyed my self-confidence, destroyed everything about me, and led me into thinking there was no way that the God of the Bible would care about me anyway, so I'd already been forgotten. It doesn't really matter anyway. And, you know, I graduated high school, and I went to NC State and was put in a dorm with a bunch of big-time jocks who also really enjoyed narcotics, and they decided they were going to make it their mission to toughen me up. And by that, it would be lock me out of my dorm room, hold me down, and force hard liquor down my throat, all sorts of stuff like that. Just pretty heinous stuff. And I have used it as an excuse that's probably further than it goes, but I ended up getting two consecutive 0.0 GPAs. I was beyond depressed. I had got a medical withdrawal from the university, finally admitted it to my parents before final exams, and they said, I wish you had told us. We could have figured this out. And so they put me in a hotel for my final exams. And I was in the hotel room wondering if I could get the glass out of the window and jump. That's how bad off I was at this point. Some self-inflicted, a lot. I just was not, it's not that I was sheltered, but I wasn't prepared for this. I wasn't ready for this. So I came back and I saw a therapist for a little while and started working a little bit of retail and ended up moving to Asheville to go to college again, stay with a couple of my high school friends. And for the most part, I guess everything was all right. But the retail jobs never went anywhere, either because of something I did or just not a good company or whatever. It was just flippant and nothing was working out. I, at this point, was kind of a failure, really. Like, I was voted most likely to become president of the United States. I'm the guy that in front of the United Methodist Church, when they asked me who I wanted to be when I grew up, I said Tom Brokaw, which is something I'll never forget because everybody from the church still talks about it when they see me or hear anything from me. And then I wanted to be a lawyer, and I wanted to be president. And when I went to NC State, I was going to be pre-law. And everything got derailed. Everything got derailed. Also can tell you at this point that I'm about 300 pounds probably at this stage. I would get as high in 2015, 2016 as 370. I thought I was going to be dead before 40. I was sure. I even said I was just like, even when I was interning and starting to do more work at 104.5 The Zone here, I still thought, all I got to do is make it to about 38, 39, I'm good. I'm ready to go. There's nothing left. Again, empty, depressed, alone. But before I came to Kentucky, I ended up going to South Carolina and I worked in professional wrestling for 9 years. I wrote scripts, I booked the talent, I did an on-camera manager role, I was a ring announcer, I was a television commentator, did it all. Grew up around it. My grandfather on my father's side loved it. My father loved it. My grandma and I watched it together. It was my thing. Grew up loving pro wrestling and Back to the Future. If you knew that, then you knew me. And I went in that industry and made no money because there was no money to make. It was all about paying dues. It was all about pay your own gas, or maybe we'll give you $10 and a hot dog. And somehow I thought that was going to get me somewhere. And that's how a lot of the people that are now making millions of dollars, that's the only way to do it. That's the way that it's done. But there was a time when that pathway needed to come to an end, and it did. I ended up off and on with a girl who I was living with in 2009. And I think at this point it was just, this got to be my last chance. Not attractive, very overweight, not in good health, don't have a job. There's no reason for anyone to want me. So I better marry her. And so I got back with her. I broke her old boyfriend with her, or broke them up, because I had already broken up with her at least once. And I'd never been back with anyone before. I hadn't had that many girlfriends to begin with because, again, when you get caught into pornography for a long period of time, it destroys your confidence enough that you're socially awkward and you don't even ask girls anymore. You don't talk to them anymore. You don't even view them the same way anymore. And so I had three real, what I would call, girlfriends. And then she came around. And then in 2009, when we were going through all this, I had this talk one night with myself, and I said, okay, you're either going to marry her or you're going to leave town. There's nothing left in South Carolina for you. Your parents are in Kentucky. It might be time to go. And I realized in that moment that because I had to make that kind of a decision, I already knew the answer. Because you don't say, I'm either going to marry her or I'm going to leave town altogether. I already knew, okay, so I got to go. So I told her, and it was painful for her, extremely. I got out of there, and I went to Kentucky and had to swallow my pride again and just say, whatever was going on in South Carolina, it's dried up, there's nothing left. Mom and Dad, can I come home in my 30s with nothing to show for my life? And by the grace of God, they were my parents. Everybody that has a bad story about their mom and dad, I don't have it. When I hear that, I feel horrible for those people, but I can't relate. My dad was a workaholic, and yeah, you know, he was an old school parent, and I received my share of punishments, and there were times that he could be a little dismissive and harsh, but he was a wonderful dad in so many ways. And again, I never knew how close to the line we actually were. He and Mom made it so I never figured it out. We always had enough, probably too much, quite frankly. But I went to Kentucky. Remember, I had 2 0.0s. One of them got dropped because of medical withdrawal, but not both. So I had a 0.0 GPA, plus what I'd done in community college in Asheville, which was good. And Western Kentucky happened to be in Bowling Green, where my parents live. And so I said, you know, I'm going to apply. It was after a year of being there and doing nothing. I said, I'm just going to apply. I bet they will reject me, but I'm going to apply. Somehow I got in. And then a switch flipped. And then it was all the stuff that I'd been told that I could do, I did. I ended up with multiple scholarships coming out of WKU, the Bob Proctor Scholarship, the Senior Broadcaster of the Year Scholarship. I won an AP Associated Press Award. I interned at The Zone in Nashville, while also interning for an AM radio station in Bowling Green. I took what I learned in professional wrestling and what I'd done just when I spoke in public or spoke to various people through different things or sung or performed. I took all of it and just said, why don't you actually just go do something with it? Like, do you actually want to do something? You want to continue to get a hot dog and go over here to the show? And it worked out. And when I interned with The Zone, they ended up hiring me before I graduated high school or graduated college in 2013. And I was set. Everything's good. By the way, I'm still not right with God in any way, shape, or form. My prayers, when I prayed, were always the same. It was the same five things in the exact same order, and then it was an amen. And then there was a lot of stuff like, please help me break this addiction. But I never believed it to be possible. I used to put a post-it note on my bathroom wall, and it would be a number, and it would be a 1, 2, 3, or as high as I could go, and it was that many days without succumbing to temptation. I'd get to 3 and I'd feel like I was there, and the next day that 3 was gone and there wasn't a 1 up there either. Every day I thought I had it lit was over. I made it a month. And then the relapse was atrocious. And so I knew this was never going to happen. Super overweight. Ate nothing that was good at all. Super picky eater, didn't try anything. So I ate junk all the time, junk and fast food, religiously all the time. I was known for being able to grab a Little Caesars, hot and ready, eat it, polish it off with a bag of Doritos, and maybe grab a Blizzard from Dairy Queen on the way home for dessert. Did it all the time. Made myself sick by the way I ate. It was just the way it was. I didn't take care of myself because I didn't care about myself. I was somehow selfish and completely absent at the same time. I was so selfish to think the way that I thought and to be so focused on me at all times, but at the same time, I also didn't think about the people that did know me and the people that did love me or did care about me in those moments. problem with being hired at a place like The Zone, in an industry like radio or television, is that a lot of times you get hired before there's a job for you. I didn't recognize that, but I was hired, but they didn't have a spot for me. They just didn't want me to go anywhere. They knew there was a future for me there, but there wasn't necessarily a present. So then I was driving an hour from Kentucky to run an audio board for 2 hours to make $20 and then drive that hour back 3 or 4 days a week. Was making no money. My car was getting destroyed. I was in the same place I was before, except I felt like I worked for this great company, and I know that I could give them a lot, but nothing's happening. So, again, super depressed and just dejected. And even my parents are like, what's happening here? And I even told God, I'm like, if I got this wrong, again, not walking with Christ at all, but I'm just like, God, just help me figure out something else to do. I think I just kind of reached out blindly to him at that point in time. It's okay. If I'm not supposed to do this, that's fine. But I don't understand why I can't continue to do this. And within a week, I got a phone call from somebody that was a lot bigger than me at The Zone, who offered me the opportunity I hadn't had. Now, I had hosted a show on Sundays at The Zone that they gave me, but it wasn't a paid show. It was just me doing it for free, and a Saturday show where I was doing it for free as well. But this guy called me on Sunday night and he said, I've left The Zone. Fox has just offered me a national morning show. What do you think about being my executive producer? And I mean, I was about to walk away from the business. I was about ready to send the email and be done and try to figure something else out with my life. And I said, Clay, I'll take it. And so I became Clay Travis's first executive producer for Fox Sports Radio. And all the negatives that can be said about Clay, you won't get them from me. Not because of that opportunity. He didn't know me that well. That was actually recommended by people there that knew him and knew me and said, he's perfect for you. It's about how he treated me once I got there and what he's done for me since in my life. Not that he isn't flawed, has many failings, but the loyalty that he showed, the way that he told me that I was better than I gave myself credit for. When I got married to Abby, we stayed in his house at Rosemary Beach, which he had never given to anybody. And we got there and there was like gifts on the table and everybody knew we were going to be there. Clay has said, make sure you're treated like royalty and not like just stuff that you don't have to do. And he did it anyway. So I went to Fox and we were working 5 to 8 a.m. Guess what? I still lived in Kentucky. So I was commuting from about 3 a.m. to get there, produce the show, and then drive back. I was sleeping in gas station parking lots because I was running off the road on the drive home because I was so tired. But finally had a salary, finally had a little something. And it continued that way. And when Clay would take time off, there would be guest hosts. Again, not sure why, but he went to Fox and he's like, why don't you give Jason a shot? Why don't you let him do it? And I don't have a national presence. I don't have a national name. Why? Well, because Clay had control of his show. They listened to him. And they said, yeah, all right, we'll try him out. I'm still doing it. In 2024, I'm still doing it. When their morning show that replaced Clay is out, I'm usually the guy. I was the guy on Black Friday, just less than a week ago, as a matter of fact. That then parlayed to me hosting a Sunday morning show from 2 a.m. to 5 a.m. solo by myself on national radio, all came from Clay. And then that changed to the thing that I'm doing now on Saturday nights from 10 p.m. to 1 a.m. with a co-host that I now do out of my home with a studio that we have upstairs so that I don't have to drive downtown in the midst of that craziness and scare Abby to death, wondering where I am and if I'm safe, and me worrying about the wrong person seeing me leave my wife and two daughters behind at that point. So I jumped the gun to tell you the work-related part of this story, but remember, I'm way out of shape, and I still think that I'm going to be... Now, I'm on the air talking about I have not... This is just, again, part of the flaw of this entire situation, and what actually led me away from Clay was that where he was in his life and where he always had been from a secular standpoint began to bother me. We'd go to the Super Bowl and it would be about my 10-year virginity on the air and how that could be fixed and stuff like that. Like, and I told him, I was like, I'm willing to play the beta here to your alpha. I think it'll be fun. I think that's because I didn't have the self-confidence to tell him I don't want to do that, because self-deprecation became a really easy way for me to have a defense mechanism against everything that was happening. But increasingly I would go home after there were jokes being told about pornography and all this, and I'm in the midst of this struggle where I would just be like, what's happening? What's going on here? Like, there's a major disconnect in your life, and it doesn't feel right. I'm also, by the way, his pop culture writer. I'm writing content about television shows and movies. I'm getting invites to all these screenings. I'm starting to make a name for myself there as well on his website. Again, he gave me a platform to do that. And eventually I just told Clay I'm probably going to need to step away. And the reason why is because sometime during that part, I finally moved here. And I remember I moved here, and right around that same time, he gave me a bonus check at the end of the year that paid off my loan. I was able to pay it off in one fell swoop. And it was just like, okay, well, now I'm debt-free. Now I should probably leave my parents, because they were helping me build something by letting me stay under their roof and not charging me anything. Yeah, I had to swallow pride, and I didn't love it, but it's time now. I'm glad I had, because of the deterioration that would follow in their health. But I moved here, and I'm not sure why, but I just all of a sudden decided I wanted to go to church again. I haven't been to church since high school. And so I went to Brentwood United Methodist. I don't know who it was that recommended it, but I started going there, and I really liked it. Thought Dave Chappell was a really powerful pastor as a preacher. And I went and saw him on my birthday. I remember my birthday, I think I want to go sit down with the preacher. So I reached out and set it up. And I went there and talked to him. He gave me some books and all this. And, all the while, I'm still just trying to find a wife. That's the sad thing about it. Everything that's happening is like the three things that I prayed for that I never thought that I would get. It's just like, I know this is impossible, Lord, but if I could just lose some weight, if I could get over this addiction, if I could just find the woman that, if there is one, the woman you put here for me. I know they're not going to happen, but I have to ask. When I went to the Super Bowl in Houston, on the way back, I had to ask for a seatbelt extender because I was so big I couldn't fit into just one seat comfortably. I don't know what it was, but something struck me. And just, how long are you going to do this? Is this enough? And so that weekend, I just woke up one day and decided that carbs weren't going to be a thing for me anymore. And sugar wasn't going to be a thing for me anymore. I'd heard about diets and all that kind of stuff, but Planet Fitness. I went and grabbed this membership like a year ago. Maybe I could just go and start walking on the treadmill. And so all these things happened sort of in concert at the same time. So I started going, and I'm still in Bowling Green at this point. I start walking on the treadmill, and I'm embarrassed because I see everybody else there that's in shape, and I'm out of breath in 10 minutes of walking. But there was a small voice that was just keep on going. Just keep on going. And so I, against all odds kept going. Around this time, I had to get a physical for work. First time I got a physical in a long time, and they did blood work for the first time in my life. My dad was diabetic, had high blood pressure. My brother was way more obese than I ever was and still is. Mom has diabetes as well. So I was just waiting for the obvious. Okay, just tell me what I already know. And, you know, the doctor came in and he's like, you know, you're weighing about 365 right now. And I said, well, you know, I did start going to the gym last couple of weeks and I'm starting to try to eat a little better. And he said, well, keep that up. We're going to see you again in 6 weeks. This was going to coincide with about a week before I moved to Nashville. And during that 6 weeks, I did exactly that. I ate the way that I all of a sudden thought I needed to start eating. I continued doing the exercise thing. And I didn't think I'd lost anything at all. And the thing is, when you're in first person, when you're in first person perspective, you're in your body all day, you don't see the changes at all. So I just think, oh, I'm still doing basically the same stuff I was doing. This is probably not going to work. But 6 weeks later, I went to the doctor, and they were going to weigh me again. And I remember praying before the doctor walked in the room to tell me the results of things. I was just like, just have him tell me I lost a pound. Just a pound. So that I'll feel like it worked a little bit. I tried really hard. The doctor comes in and he does this and he makes me fist pound him. And he says, you've lost 31 pounds in 6 weeks. And your blood work is perfect. He goes, in fact, your cholesterol might be a little low. And he walked back out of the room and there's nobody in the room. And two words just rang out, blank slate. All of what you thought, just keep on this pathway, blank slate, blank slate. And at that point, it started to dawn on me that this wasn't about me at all. This was about an answered prayer, but it was also about the Lord wanting me to recognize the work he was doing in my life. That made it a lot easier to keep going. When I moved to Nashville, the apartment complex that I chose, the first one I looked at, I was like, yep, I'll take it. Stupidly, it was in Antioch and all this kind of stuff, right? They had a gym in the apartment complex. So there was no reason for me not to continue going. It was going to be part of my rent, and it was almost always going to be empty. And even if it snowed, I could get there. Even if it iced, I could get there. And I did, 5 days a week. And I ate incessantly well. And in the first year, I lost 128 pounds. And then the next year, I added another 90 on top of that. When I got married, I was 181 pounds. That's God. I treated my body like trash. I treated myself like trash. I was addicted to pornography. I was alone. I was doing all the wrong things. I was making all the wrong jokes. All this kind of stuff. But he still had a hold on me. I just didn't know it. That time when I was back at Pothtown Baptist Church in Winston-Salem, said, I'll get right with you one day. He's going to hold me to that, apparently. So that was step one, is the weight started to come off. And then everybody said, oh, don't let it come back. Well, it hasn't. Matter of fact, it's fluctuated. It's gone up and it's gone down. I think it was 177 a year ago. Now I'm right around 200. It's probably healthier. So then I moved here. Again, it all kept up. So the weight is there. But I'm still living in an apartment. And I've still got access to the internet. And I've still got a lot of storage area. And so I've still got all the problems that I had before. And they didn't go away. they got stronger and stronger to where I would be so ashamed that I couldn't even look up. It's just like, I can't even pray to you. Like, I really go away. And I, again, just thought that one was not going to end. At the same time, I was doing the online dating thing, and that wasn't going to work out either. So I'm still alone. I'm still, like, only part of this is working out. And then, you know, I was with, I would meet a few people, and I remember meeting one that I knew was definitely wrong. But I was just like, I actually even said this. I was like, Lord, just give me the wrong thing for a little while. Even if I know it's wrong, give me a little fun for a little while. And he just wouldn't do it. And I'm very grateful that he didn't. There was a day after I moved here that I was on the couch in the afternoon. And I called up a friend and I was just like, I am so depressed right now, I can't get off this couch. I literally physically cannot get off this couch. And that's when he replies, well, have you ever prayed the Psalms? He starts talking to me about Psalms. He starts talking to me about Lamentations. And I'm just like, Psalms are all these high in the sky. And it's like, no, like a third of them are laments. You need to read them. So then I start reading the Bible more and more. The people that I went to school with, all of them, there were some really good people, but the three that I was probably the closest with all had jobs in media. One was a morning television anchor in Wisconsin. Another was about to potentially be the sports information director at Indiana. And a third was the beat writer in Kentucky for high school sports. All of them are now ministers. All of them. They all walked away. One is now with Young Life, doing great work. Another is now a senior pastor in Wisconsin after leaving that job. And the third one is now the congressional care pastor in Bowling Green at the church that he is at, and married another woman that worked in that church as well in the pregnancy center. All of them did this. But the change happened when, after I started doing all those things, I finally did the thing that I never thought that I would be capable of doing, which is telling one of them, I've been addicted to pornography for over 30 years, and just expecting to hear a dial tone on the other end of the phone. I truly believe pornography is the worst sin imaginable because it is so isolating. The enemy just comes in and says, you are the worst person that ever existed. You can't tell anyone about this. This is between you and me. God doesn't love you. Everyone else will run from you if you tell them this. So I tell this guy this, and this guy's a minister, right? He's working in Young Life. And his response, I had to admit to my wife 6 months ago that I've been powerless over pornography for decades. Talk to one of the other ones. Same thing. Come to find out, what I thought was so isolating, in fact, was very common. And that changed my entire perspective on it. And it's why I have no problem sharing it in any size room, because I just am so passionate that no one falls into it in any way, shape, or form. And I was so worried during COVID that it was going to happen to people because they had nothing but time and nothing but technology. And they were so much more vulnerable at that time. The last day that I looked at pornography was December 31st, 2018. I met this girl through an online dating app around the time that I was going to give up in January of that year. And for a year, we had hung out off and on, but we were just friends. She was not going to allow us to be more than that. Just something was stopping her. She wasn't getting a green light from the Lord. It was really frustrating me because I felt like the green light was there from moment one when we met at Panera and she apparently wanted to eat and I didn't know it. And then she had said we were meeting for coffee. And so she went home hungry and debated never talking to me again because I was so out to lunch. No pun intended. And that first night at Panera, there was this voice in my head that said, pay attention to this one, she's different. And so we spent time, we hiked at Radnor Lake together, we went to various concerts at the Ryman, I took her to movie premieres here and there and stuff like that. She didn't know who I was, she didn't care who Clay was, she didn't know anything about radio, which is fantastic. I'm begging the Lord, why can't she see this? Or am I the one that's wrong? I can't be the one that's wrong. And December 31st happens, and that's the night where I'm just like, Lord, I can't do this, but you can carry me through this swamp. After I gave in, I was just like, it's got to be the last time, but I can't do it. But you can. You can. And every day he does. And the day that I say I have it beaten will be the day that I fall back into it. As long as I continue to let him carry me every day, I'm going to be okay. But that next day was New Year's 2019, and I'd gotten a sense for a few weeks that maybe she was starting to turn just a little bit. And she had told me very early in our relationship that if she ever baked for me, I would know something had happened. And she probably thought I'd forgotten that, but we were going to go to a concert downtown to celebrate the new year. And everybody was telling me, this is it, this is it. And I was just trying not to get my hopes up. And got to her house and said, oh, there's one more thing. We were exchanging gifts. And then she's like, I baked this for you. And it hit me immediately. I was just, oh, maybe I'm actually right. So the switch flipped at the concert. And then 9 months later, we got married. And she was a member of this church. And she had started taking me to Kairos around August of 2018. And so on Tuesdays, we would get together and go to Kairos. And then she'd say, have a good week. And drove me insane. I was like, have a good week. How about you talk to me every day? Because aren't you seeing this? She has told me since that sometime around October, she kind of sensed it. She realized she wanted to be around me more than anybody else in her life, and that I had become her best friend, and that, you know, the Lord had done it. What I have said since, we met with Ken Core, we did the premarital counseling, we did the whole nine. And he even said, he goes, how did you guys not meet before? This is like one of the best matches I've ever seen. We didn't argue, we didn't have issues, everything was good. And then we got married in September. But the thing that I learned is to wait for the Lord's timing. If he had given that to me in July, I wasn't ready. If he had said, yes, you can take care of one of my daughters, I wouldn't have been ready. She wouldn't have been ready. I wish I could have met her 15 years ago. No, I don't. I was a mess. I had a lot of things to learn and go through and fail and come back from. But once that switch flipped, something had changed, because every relationship that happens now, the vast majority of them, are built around sex and everything else long before marriage. That's all I ever knew too. But because she kept saying no, we got to know each other the way my parents did and the way their parents did, where we just went out on dates. We didn't even call them dates. I was hoping that she would think it was a date, but it never was. But we're still spending time. We're eating dinner. We're hiking. We're talking. We're learning. We're worshiping together. We're doing all these things without the awkwardness that comes with the other side. And so we were friends first. It wasn't, well, we're attracted to one another. Let's see if we can make the rest of it work. It's all, the rest of it is beautiful. And this has always kind of been here too. And so his plan and his timing on all of this, all of it played out in such a way where my professional life got under control, and then my weight gets under control, and then all of a sudden, now maybe it's time for me to show you someone. And even after all of that, and our marriage, it goes well, then COVID hits, and then we get a dog. Never had a dog. We had cats my whole life. Now we have Margot, and I love her. And then the year after, I guess the dog was a setup for the human being that would join our life in 2021 in Clara Grace. And I lost my job in 2022. After 2 years, finally got shot in mornings myself on the zone after having let Clay move on and said, I kind of need to go a different pathway. I've broken free of this addiction. The Lord's carrying me to a different place, and I don't feel like I can live both lives. Super supportive all the way through. Finally got that chance. After being told forever that it was coming, I got called during the pandemic. Hey, you're coming back, and you're coming back as the host of the morning show that's been on for 20 years. You're replacing all these guys. And they were legends. And a lot of people never gave me a chance as a result of that. And I may have leaned into that too much. But I ended up losing my job the day that I came back from a Titans practice. And they said they wanted to see me. I said, oh, it's time to sign my extension. Our ratings are through the roof, and we're sold out, and all this kind of stuff. They brought me in, and they said, we're going to go a different direction. You did your last show this morning. And so I had to call Abby, and now we have a child, and say, I can't quite believe this. I thought I was about to sign a new contract, and they let me go. And they wanted to walk me out of the building so there wouldn't be a scene. And I said, you don't know me at all, do you? And I haven't really worked since. I still do the Saturday night show on Fox, but I fell into another season of depression. I met with Mike Glenn. I met with Ken Kaur. Talked to them. They talked me through some things. And in 2023, I happened to show up on a Sunday, really excited to come to church. Usually after doing a Saturday night show that late, it would be a struggle. But for some reason, I really want to go to church today. And I'd had it out with the Lord a week or two before, walking the dog. I was just like, Lord, I give up. My wife is starting to really wonder. I'm afraid that her parents are going to think I'm a failure, that she somehow screwed up. After waiting for so long, she got the wrong guy. It turns out I'm the same guy that I was afraid I was 20 years ago. But whatever you want to do, just do it. Take me. Use me. Do whatever. Months before, some people had suggested to me, volunteer. And so I started volunteering at Grace Works and ended up becoming a Grace Worker, where I sat down with people and I heard them tell their stories. And I said, hey, we're going to pay your bill this month. We're going to pay this power bill. We're going to call MTE. We're going to handle this. We're going to look at your water. All this. I just want to be anonymous. I want to be left alone. And I'm begging the Lord, like, why?